Collins. Here on Radio 4FM, it's time for our new book of the week. In Deep, the American journalist James Nestor sets off to investigate the dangerous and enthralling world of free diving and underwater exploration. The reader is William Hope.
It is 5:30 in the morning, and I'm at the Kalamata Marina in Greece, talking my way onto a 27-foot sailboat that belongs to a scruffy Quebecois expat. I'm a journalist, and I've been sent here to cover the 2011 Individual Depth World Championship, the largest gathering of athletes in the history of competitive freediving. The contest will take place in the deep open waters about 10 miles out, and this is the only spectator boat allowed. I've lived my whole life by the ocean and often write about it, so my editor thought I'd be a good fit for the assignment. What he didn't know was that I didn't know anything about free diving, didn't know anyone who had done it, and had never seen it before. By 8 a.m., we've tied up to a flotilla of motorboats, platforms, and gear that serves as the competitors' jumping-off point. The first divers show up wearing hooded wetsuits and insectoid goggles. They slide into the sea like otters and take positions around three yellow ropes dangling off a nearby platform. An official counts down from 10. What I see next will confound and terrify me. I watch as a pencil-thin New Zealander named William Troubridge swallows a breath and kicks with bare feet into the crystalline water below. Troubridge struggles through the first 10 feet. Then, at about 20 feet, his body loosens. He places his arms by his sides and sinks steadily deeper until he vanishes. An official watching a sonar screen at the surface follows his descent. 30 meters. 40 meters. 50 meters. Troubridge reaches the end of the rope, some 300 feet down, turns around, and swims back toward the surface. 3 agonizing minutes later, his tiny figure rematerializes in the deep water. He pops his head up at the surface, then makes room for the next competitor. Troubridge just dove 30 stories down and back, all on one lungful of air. No scuba gear, air tube, or even swim fins to assist him. I'm dazzled by what I've seen. The pressure at 300 feet down is more than 10 times that of the surface, strong enough to crush a Coke can. And yet Troubridge and most of the other free divers I watch on the first day resurface unscathed. Over the next 4 days, though, I watch several more competitors attempt dives to that level who can't make it and turn back. They resurface with blood running from their noses, unconscious or in cardiac arrest. And somehow this sport is legal. But I meet a number of competitors who approach freediving with a more sane outlook. They freedive because it's the most direct and intimate way to connect with the ocean. They get a glassy look in their eyes when they describe their experiences. The ocean changes us psychically and physically. I begin to research freediving and the claims made by competitors about the human body's amphibious possibilities. What I find is that this phenomenon is real. Per Hollander, a Swedish-born researcher, follows in an established line of scientists who have long been fascinated by the extraordinary dive reflexes of mammals. He had seen the biological functions of Weddell seals reverse in deep water. The seals actually seemed to gain oxygen the longer and deeper they dived. Hollander wondered if water could trigger this effect in humans. In 1962, he experimented by leading a team of volunteers into an enormous water tank and monitoring their heart rates as they dived down to the bottom of the tank. Water triggered an immediate decrease in heart rate. Next, Hollander told the volunteers to hold their breath, dive down, strap themselves into fitness equipment submerged at the bottom of the tank, and do a short, vigorous workout. No matter how hard the volunteers exercised, their heart rates still plummeted. The volunteers' slower heart rates meant that they used less oxygen and therefore could stay underwater longer. He noticed something else. Once his volunteers were underwater, the blood in their bodies began flooding away from their limbs and toward their vital organs. When a diver descends to 300 feet, vessels in the lungs engorge with blood, preventing them from collapse. And the deeper we dive, the stronger the amphibious reflexes become. A person need submerge only his face in water to activate these life-lengthening reflexes. Hollander had documented a change that occurred only in water. He called it the master switch of life. In Kalamata, it is time for a two-day rest in the freediving competition. The courtyard at the local hotel buzzes with a dozen languages as teams gather around patio tables to sip bottled water, talk strategy, and email worried relatives. I find an empty table in the shade of the courtyard. I've scheduled a freediving lesson with Hunley Prinsloo, a national record holder and instructor from South Africa. So far, the mere thought of freediving made me claustrophobic. Aside from a few graceful and awe-inspiring dives from champions like Troubridge, most attempts looked awkward and dangerous. Prinsloo insisted that there was more to free diving than trying to beat your opponents. "It offers a stillness," she told me, "and there was no need to force yourself down to 300 feet to find it. The most incredible transformation happened at around 40 feet down. There, the water stopped buoying your body toward the surface and instead started pulling you deeper. This was the so-called doorway to the deep, and anyone could pass through it, even me. To prove it, Prinsloo offered me an out-of-water session where we'd work on increasing my breath-holding capacity. The lesson begins with some basic poses to loosen the muscles around our chests. Through stretching and breathing exercises, free divers develop up to 75% more lung capacity than the average person. Next, Prinsloo takes me through a few human pretzel poses designed to help open my lungs. Then, we sit cross-legged facing each other. She directs me to draw a 20-second breath into the belly area, sternum, and top of the chest. She pulls out her stopwatch and gets ready to time my first breath hold attempt. I lie down, take one more enormous breath, and hold it. She starts the clock. What feels like 30 seconds pass. I'm extremely nauseated. I imagine for a moment what it must be like to be 100 feet underwater and feeling this awful. This thought triggers panic. A few seconds later, my body starts convulsing. Prinsloo stops the watch and tells me to exhale, then inhale. I sit up, feeling like a failure, but she shows me the stopwatch. I've just held my breath 1 minute and 45 seconds. I ask about the convulsions. She explains that the body responds to extreme breath holding in three stages. Convulsions are the first stage response. When that starts, it's just a caution that you've only got a few minutes to go before you really need to breathe. The second stage response occurs when the spleen releases fresh, oxygen-rich blood into the bloodstream. A free diver anticipates the spleen's delivery of fresh blood, feels it happen, and uses it as a turbocharge to dive even deeper. The third stage response is the blackout, which happens when the brain senses that there's not enough oxygen for it to support itself and so shuts off like a light switch to conserve energy. Free divers learn to sense the arrival of convulsions and spleen release, and they know exactly when to head back to the surface, so the third stage, blackout, won't occur. Prinsloo shifts me into yet another yoga pose. She encourages me. You are born to do this. I lie on my back for my final breath-holding attempt of the day. Inhale. Exhale. Big inhale. Hold. Prinsloo starts the stopwatch. I close my eyes. After what feels like about 20 seconds, I start gently convulsing again. I tell myself this is natural, to concentrate, keep relaxed, wait for the spleen to kick in. It's hard to wait. My chest feels pressurized and my heart pounds so forcibly that I can sense it in my hands, legs, crotch. I feel miserable. Stick with it, Prinsloo assures me. I stick with it. I feel claustrophobic. Soon, my body feels electrified. I notice I'm wriggling on the mat like a fish out of water. Right now, your spleen is filling your body with fresh, oxygen-rich blood, she says. Moments later, I think I can sense what she's talking about. My body calms, and I feel like I'm drifting off to... Breathe, she says. I exhale, inhale, exhale. I'm dizzy, have trouble focusing through fluttering eyes, but I feel good. How long do you think that was? She asks me. I shrug and guess about a minute or so. She smiles. I didn't just double my breath-holding record during this lesson, I tripled it. The stopwatch reads 3 minutes, 10 seconds. Humans may well be born to free dive, but that doesn't mean it's easy. You still have to hold your breath a long time, exert yourself to your breaking point, and not freak out. Saturday, the final day of the competition, brings scorching sunshine, still air, and clear, calm waters. Perfect conditions. Over the week, I have experienced the extremes. Records have been attempted, and I've seen dozens of divers plunging without incident. But I've also started to get used to seeing unconscious bodies pulled from 60 feet down. It's madness. On the final night, the divers, coaches, and judges gather on the beach for the closing ceremonies. All told, the divers broke 2 world and 48 national records. Competitors also suffered 19 blackouts. Troubridge won gold in 2 categories. There is such a strong community here, says Hunley Prinsloo. We have to be in the water. We've chosen to live our lives in it, and by doing that, we accept its risks. But we also reap its rewards.
William Hope was reading Deep by James Nestor. It was abridged and produced by Pippa Vaughan, and it's a Loftus production for BBC Radio 4. In tomorrow's episode, Nestor goes looking for sharks. Now, with the opening of the Commonwealth Games just days away, who are the key sportswomen to keep an eye on? Woman's Hour will have the ones to watch in a couple of minutes. And speaking of the Commonwealth...
The origins of the idea of the Commonwealth can be traced as far back as the turn of the 20th century.
The history of the Commonwealth.
The very idea of the Commonwealth emerged out of the brutal and brutalizing experience of the Boer War, the South African War.
A union that's harbored tensions.
The Commonwealth waged a crusade on behalf of the ending of apartheid. We had problems within the Commonwealth, particularly with the British government under Margaret Thatcher.
The Paper Commonwealth on BBC Radio 4, this morning at 11 o'clock.